There's an impeachment inquiry up and running in the House of Representatives. This isn't something we do very often. So it seems like it would make sense to look back at the few cases of impeachment we have tried to understand how it all works and learn lessons for the present day. But hold on. Our next guest is a historian who says the ghost of impeachment's past may not be able to tell us that much about the present and future. David Greenberg is a professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University. He wrote about the lessons we can and can't learn from the history of impeachment in a piece in Politico. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
What are some of the hazards of using those past, two and a half impeachments, I guess, to try to learn lessons for today?
Right. Well, I'm all for people studying and knowing history. But it's dangerous to expect history to give us neat lessons, that we shouldn't expect something that unfolded in 1974 or 1998 will unfold similarly today. The situation with Trump is just too different from our previous impeachments. We've only had three, or as you say, two and a half impeachments, because Nixon quit before the machinery could really go into high gear. And so we have to be very gingerly and constrained in drawing hard and fast lessons from these past experiences.
In that piece in Politico, you kind of give a capsule summary of each of the impeachments and what was unique about them. I want to take a quick tour of those, and let's start with Andrew Johnson. It was a very different impeachment than the other ones we've seen.
Absolutely. I mean, Johnson, as listeners may know, became president only on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He was a Southerner from Tennessee who had been chosen by Lincoln as vice president as a sort of unity ticket, a union ticket, so that you could have North and South and Democrat and Republican represented on the same ticket. So he really represented a very different philosophy from Lincoln, and then basically got to warring with the radical Republicans in Congress over how the post-Civil War policy of Reconstruction, including civil rights for former slaves, should unfold. He was impeached really on some technicalities that I think most historians agree were not impeachable offenses. On the merits of policy, I think most people look back and would have sympathy with the Republicans in Congress who wanted a more generous extension of civil rights to Black Americans, who wanted a more aggressive policy of Reconstruction. But that's not what was up for debate. What was up for debate was whether he had violated certain laws and whether that really was an impeachable offense. And in the end, he just skated by with acquittal.
Okay, now, unless vampires are real, no one here today was there for Andrew Johnson. The other ones come back into lifetimes of some people listening. Richard Nixon, we hear a lot about Watergate. Those questions of legitimacy, should Nixon have been impeached and would he have been impeached? How do you apply those in that case of Watergate?
Right. So in the Johnson case, I look at sort of the separate questions of constitutionality. Were the grounds there for impeachment? And also political questions. Was it possible to remove him? In Johnson, you could say, well, maybe there were grounds, and certainly it was possible. With Nixon, definitely there were grounds for impeachment, and definitely it was possible. You had a Republican Party that was very different from today's, where both a lot of liberal Republicans, a phrase we don't hear too much these days, but you know, Wisconsin used to have a number of these, and some very conservative Republicans like Barry Goldwater or James Buckley, the senator from New York, who was the brother of William F. Buckley, the conservative journalist. They were very hard on Nixon and in favor of his impeachment or resignation. And so you had much more flexibility within the parties than you see today. And so Nixon, who, of course, committed a number of constitutional crimes, abuses of power, obstruction of justice, denying congressional subpoenas. It convinced lots of Republicans that it was time for him to go.
And then the final case study is Bill Clinton. How does that meet those two standards?
So in Clinton's case, you had an impeachment charge that was not constitutionally justified, and also that was never going to happen, or almost never. I mean, it was pretty apparent from early on that the Monica Lewinsky affair, which was at the core of the impeachment charge and Clinton's responses, lying in response to questions about it, did not rise to the level, as people took to saying, of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the constitutional standard for impeachment. And it was recognized from quite early on that it was a very partisan affair. Very few Democrats supported it. Not too many Republicans opposed it, although it was significant that when the impeachment trial did go to the Senate, after the Republican-controlled House did impeach Clinton, a number of Republican senators voted no on various counts. There were four counts that were brought. And the fact that you couldn't even get all the Republicans and you could get zero Democrats showed, I think, what many people felt all along, that it was a very partisan affair from the beginning. It had grown out of the Whitewater investigation, which was a real estate deal that Clinton had participated in while still governor of Arkansas, and it had somehow morphed into an investigation of his sex life. And I think the public and most political observers, although not necessarily the Washington media, felt that while Clinton certainly didn't acquit himself personally, he deserved to be acquitted under the standards of constitutional law.
Talking to historian David Greenberg from Rutgers University. He wrote a piece that says it may be hard to draw lessons from impeachment's past to look at what's going on today, but we might have some precedents set. I want to give a listen to current Senator Lindsey Graham. Back in 1999, he was, I think, a House manager for impeachment. Here's a pair of clips from him from the same speech that CNN played back to back.
You don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
David, do you see potentially people looking back to arguments made in the Clinton impeachment and the Nixon almost impeachment to justify actions today in the Trump impeachment effort?
Well, sure. And a lot of people are going to be looking, as Senator Graham seems to appear, a bit hypocritical. The problem is that the two men are accused of very different things. One is accused of covering up a sexual encounter, and one is accused of encouraging a foreign nation to intervene with our democratic processes. The fact that there's such different alleged crimes or wrongdoings makes those comparisons, I think, of, you know, relatively little value. The other thing I think Senator Graham said that's sort of mistaken is to say, well, you don't have to be convicted of a crime. It harkens back to a famous claim by Gerald Ford that you could be impeached for whatever the House and Senate at a given moment in time deem impeachable. Now, that is technically true, but what they are doing is losing sight of, you know, what they call the is-ought distinction, what Congress can do and what Congress should do. Of course, it's possible to impeach someone on specious grounds if you simply have the votes to do it. But we don't really think our government should work that way. We think that you should only be impeached for what the Constitution specifies as high crimes and misdemeanors. So then we have to debate whether covering up an affair is a high crime or misdemeanor. Most people would say no. Or whether Trump's actions in the case of Ukraine, or perhaps some of the other previous questions relating to the 2016 election, amount to high crimes and misdemeanors. And that certainly, at the least, is an open debate.
We're talking to Professor David Greenberg from Rutgers, where he teaches history and journalism and media studies. He says past cases of impeachment may not teach us much about what's happening today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were following the Nixon or Clinton impeachment efforts at the time, what do you remember? Did you experience both of them? You want to compare and contrast? Do you have comparisons to the modern day, or do you have a question for our guest about all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with historian and journalism professor David Greenberg from Rutgers. We're talking about the lessons we can take away from past impeachments, or not, as we are in uncharted waters with the current impeachment process. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, one unique element, of course, is, as you were touching on, President Trump himself. He was on the White House lawn this morning taking questions. He mentioned an upcoming meeting with the Chinese on trade next week and then reiterated his recommendations for Ukraine's government.
They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
So we've got this weird case where Democrats are saying asking foreign governments to intervene in the election and to target your political opponent is an impeachable offense, and the president responding by doing it again and then bringing another country into the mix. What do you make of this, David?
Well, it really does show how Trump, as you say, is a unique element in this. I mean, when we heard Richard Nixon on the tapes, we saw a side of him that is kind of like Trump, you know, foul-mouthed, petty, talking like a gangster. The difference is Trump talks this way in public. Nixon tried very hard to conceal that, to project an image that he was dignified and statesmanlike and honest and upstanding. And then people learned that it was something of a lie. With Trump, it's all out there in the open. And I think he has a very different approach, which is to figure that the people who are with him are going to be cheered by this, and the people who are against him are already against him, and so it can't get any worse. I think that's sort of a dangerous game, even though, you know, you could argue it's worked for him so far.
Let's bring on a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi. My question was that on previous impeachments of both Nixon and President Clinton, is that the opposing political side was involved in the impeachment, including the ability to subpoena witnesses and also to look for, like, in part of the fact finding. That doesn't appear to be applicable right now, that it's all being controlled only by one party. And I was wondering if that's going to make the impeachment party more polarizing than whether or not President Trump really did do something wrong.
Charlie, thanks for the call. He's saying there were bipartisan efforts on the subpoenas and things like that, David.
Well, I think certainly on the Nixon impeachment proceedings, and before that, the Senate hearings, you had at least, you know, a significant portion of the Republicans who were supportive. You know, in the Clinton case, it was very different. There was really very little Democratic support for the whole undertaking, and it was driven by Newt Gingrich and Henry Hyde, working pretty closely with Ken Starr, who, of course, though an independent counsel, was a very partisan Republican as well. So in that case, I think the partisanship of the undertaking hurt the Republicans' cause, and famously, Newt Gingrich lost seats in a rare event in the 1998 midterm elections. I do think the Democrats are going to have a hard row to hoe if they can't get Republican support. And I personally see very little prospect of that. So I do think, even if people feel that this is justified, and I think there's a strong case that impeachment is justified, it's not politically possible. I mean, it's impossible to impeach him in the House because the Democrats have the number, but it won't be possible to convict him in the Senate. And I think a lot of people will see that and wonder why the Democrats are going through this process. So I think there are some political hazards for them.
Time for one more quick call. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, what's the purpose of impeaching Trump now at this point in time when the elections are coming up so fast? Whether he did what they're accusing him of or not is irrelevant to the point of why are they doing it now.
Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. Don't have a lot of time left. David, some Democrats have said because the president, they argue, is trying to interfere in those elections.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also in 2016, when there was evidence of Trump trying to interfere in that election, President Obama didn't do much. He told Putin of Russia to cut it out because he assumed Trump was going to lose and Hillary Clinton would win. I think the Democrats, when they saw Trump doing something similar, felt they couldn't take the same path again. They couldn't follow the same script again. If they were going to make a mistake, it would be better to be caught trying, as people say. So I think it was, you know, there are risks either way. And I think the argument the caller makes is, one with some legitimacy. But either course was going to have some political perils, and I think they felt they couldn't simply replay the script of 2016 and wait till Election Day.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's David Greenberg, professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University. We talked to him today about the history of impeachment and what it can and can't tell us about the future of the current impeachment inquiry. As hospital closings continue in rural America, lots of people are looking for solutions. One Missouri program is immersing university students in small-town life. It aims to lure more medical professionals to go rural. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez-Valdivia reports.
It's a hot and sunny afternoon in Sedalia, Missouri, a town between St. Louis and Kansas City. Jennifer and Matt Boatwright are escorting some unusual visitors into a pasture on their farm.
Because we don't just turn the animals loose.
They opened the heavy gate and called the sheep over to meet a half dozen medical students from the University of Missouri system. The farm tour is part of a week-long program designed to introduce future doctors, pharmacists, and nurses to rural life. They meet local leaders, businesses, and healthcare providers. The goal, to get students interested in working in rural areas.
To understand what their role is, not only as a healthcare provider in the medical community, but what their role is as a healthcare provider in a community at large.
That's Kathleen Quinn, Associate Dean for Rural Health at the School of Medicine. The university offers other opportunities for students to work alongside rural providers, but Quinn says the immersion program gives students a picture of life in a small town. That's one of Beth Ebert's goals, as well as the director of recruitment for Bothwell Regional Health Center.
We have to make sure when they do come to visit us that they walk away saying that was such a friendly area and everyone there was so nice and they can see themselves living and working here.
Ebert says most residency programs are in much bigger cities, so it can be hard for new doctors to imagine living in a rural town of 20,000 like Sedalia. She's recruited people from all over, but one thing that can help is when prospective employees have ties to the area.
Sometimes they're from Missouri or Kansas City or nearby, and they want to come back to this area to be closer to family, whether they've been out or whether they've been in training.
Researchers say that's one of the most effective ways to recruit healthcare providers to rural areas. They call it the Grow Your Own strategy, developing a pipeline for prospective doctors and nurses from as early as middle school.
Many rural youth leave because of lack of opportunity.
Michael Meat is a researcher who focuses on health disparities between rural and urban areas. He says there's a misconception that all young people from rural areas want to leave.
I think most people, given the opportunity, are proud of their communities, are proud of their history. They want to be near their family and friends.
Magdaleno Gutierrez isn't from the area, but he's sold on rural life. The second-year medical student hails from Los Angeles, but his family comes from rural Mexico, and he says he's deeply aware of rural health needs.
I mean, not having practitioners in a rural community can make or break a rural community. And personally, my grandmother had treatable diabetes that she passed away from really early in her life due to just not having access to health care.
Gutierrez already had an interest in becoming a rural provider, but he says meeting so many community members increased his commitment.
I just haven't had that opportunity to see behind the curtain and really get to know these individuals who will hopefully be my patients one day, and get to understand and know them on a deeper level.
The University of Missouri recently received $5 million in federal grants to expand its Rural Track Pipeline program. That includes scholarships for students from rural areas and opportunities for students to do rotations at rural hospitals. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Tomorrow, our series looks at creative efforts to preserve Wisconsin's rural hospitals. These reports are part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms, including Wisconsin Public Radio, and led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more, visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's been a lot of immigration news under the radar this week amid all the impeachment stuff going on. We'll get the latest from new restrictions on refugees to some of the latest court rulings. Native tribal members from around the country could be eligible for in-state tuition at UW schools under a proposal in the state legislature. We'll talk to a lawmaker behind that proposal. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with pizza. And not just any pizza, our guest will unlock the secrets of a perfect pan pizza. I think we're going to get some Sicilian style along the way. You can get some advice and recipes and share your favorites. And if you have a pizza making secret, you can get started right now. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.